a couple more questions, but I'm going to hold them off for Franklin. And before Franklin, before I invite Franklin in, I just want to say one of the reasons that I have been so appreciative that Franklin has continued to do these precious metal reports with us is it is extremely important when we talk about money and financial systems to not do it in a way that is disassociated from the real world. One of my favorite expressions is atoms and bits. You know, we need things exist in the material world, and we can create symbols and representations for them that trade them in the world of bits, you know, on the internet or in digital systems. But ultimately, we eat and we live in the world of atoms, and we need to have financial systems that work, you know, in both if we really want to have the kind of liquidity I think many of us appreciate. But you need to understand money is simply a tool, and any currency system or any money system is only as good as the governance and leadership that governs it and manages it, and the rule of law within the society that applies it. Otherwise, you know, just like a hammer is a tool you can use to build a house, you can also use it to hit people over the head. And so it is absolutely insanity to talk about financial systems divorced from governance, divorced from law, and divorced from the practical application of how that money system works with our ownership and transfer of land or of food or any of the other not only important parts of governing and living in our world, but the sort of the mechanisms and the assets that are now targeted to be controlled very, very centrally. And so if we want to understand money, if we want to deal with money, we need to deal with it in the context of all these different control points. There's nothing more that Mr. Global would love than to have us completely disassociate and not think of it in these sort of practical ways and integrate it into the kind of political system we have. And if there's anybody who's tried to understand money in that context, it's Franklin. And so I was reminded again during dinner why I so appreciate his efforts, because to figure those things out and to understand that it's very hard to go out into the land and work with your neighbors and build a farm and build a business and build all these different things and understand how the money relates to all of them. But that's a lifetime of wisdom that he brings to us. And so without further ado, Franklin Sanders, are you with us?
Let me just start with last Friday, really, the 5th, because the 5th made a spike bottom, which is analogous to the other bottoms that we've seen over the past 6 months or so. And both gold and silver rallied up off of that. And then Monday Monday they rested a little bit, but Tuesday they were up strongly again. And so you had very strong rallies. And then suddenly gold got hit yesterday really hard and lost 80% of what it had gained in those 3 days. So it was the sort of thing that's very, very demoralizing until you look at a longer-term chart. I mean, if you look at a four-month chart, you see that we're, you know, it's just behaving like a normal market. Now, it's not good and it's dangerous down here because that last low that we saw was 1539.40, and if you break that level, say 1530 or so, then you've broken a level that's held for 2 years, and that would not be good. But the commitment, the sentiments and the commitments of traders are as favorable as they've been in 6, 8, 10 years. So from that standpoint, everything is set up for a rally. Both silver and gold on the 5th made lows. Silver's at 2658 and gold's at 1539.40. So as long as we hold 1555 on gold and $27 on silver, we're really doing okay, and the chart is not damaged. But it's seldom that we see. I mean, they use the same old tricks on Tuesday and Wednesday to break the market that they always use. They had announcements from the big banks that gold, they were lowering their gold estimates for the year, and then you had the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee meetings that made people wonder, supposedly, whether they were going to end quantitative easing. And then you had Goldman Sachs issuing a report that they expect gold by the end of 2014 to be at $1,270. This is typical. It's just this, you know, I just get tired of seeing it because it's the same old tricks that they use all the time. And you said something tonight that I thought was very interesting. It's not only the presence of things that we ought to think about and deal with, but the absence of things as well. So the presence of this attack that we saw on gold tells us that the establishment is worried about the gold price rising, so worried that they pulled out all the stops to knock it down. But the absence of what happened, the absence of effect today, which is what you pointed out to me tonight at supper, is extremely important. It did not follow through on the downside. Goldman Sachs has tons of clients that they advised to in the futures market, and however many of them sold, it was not enough to break 1550. So actually,
I don't follow Goldman Sachs. In fact, I'm famous for having written the research department a note saying, you know, I thought that they should experience a death penalty as a corporation for what was going on and not to send me their research reports anymore. That's up on the blog. But the thing that was interesting about the Goldman announcement, which I don't remember seeing before, was they said, you know, it's going to go down to here by this time, and then it's going to go down. You know, they were showing a consolidation over a year and a half, 2 year period down to 1250. And that's the way they did it was a very strong statement. It was almost a, you know, sort of subliminal threat that says, here's where we're going to take it down to. And, you know, in this sequence, so you guys better do this, that, and the other, and you know, you can count on this, and here's a way to make money. So it was very strong, and I expected to see some market response and was amazed to see essentially none.
But the absence of a response is a response too. I mean, it tells us something. It tells us that there is huge buying support for gold around $1,550 and below. And the same thing for silver at levels of below $27. So somebody's buying down there, and it's somebody big enough to push the market back up, or enough somebody's big enough to push the market back up. In addition to that, in addition to the commitments of traders being very, very positive and sentiment being very, very positive, and by that I mean the sentiment is negative, and whenever most people are negative, markets are about to turn. The premiums on physical silver remain high. Silver, 90% silver coin, it just keeps on gaining. It's the wholesale offer rate is $2.55 over melt today. So that's huge. $2.55 an ounce over spot. So anyway, that all those things point together to me to underlying strength in the market. Also, when the gold broke, the silver didn't break very much. And that was a little bit surprising too. So there's some that was mirrored in the gold silver ratio, and the ratio actually fell the day that gold fell so hard. So generally a falling ratio, and it's hard to tag these things day to day because sometimes they'll give a false signal, but generally speaking, a falling ratio does not go with a falling market. The ratio moves the opposite way of the market. Just a brief look at stocks. There's no end in sight, and I don't know when a market gets in a craze like this. There's no real way to predict a top. Just like with Bitcoin, there was no way to predict that it would get to $260 and then crash, because you're dealing with a crowd phenomenon, and the crowd is crazed one way, and what will make them panic and go the other way? Well, you can't really tell beforehand, but there's some item. But you can see, I put up a chart of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and you can see that megaphone formation, or jaws of death, as I like to call it. It's like an animal with its mouth open getting ready to snap shut, and eventually it will snap shut. The Apple chart, I put up an Apple chart that shows another megaphone formation, and you can see what happened once it got to the bottom of that formation. So, but stocks can go higher for 3 or 4 more weeks. That's just hard to tell. Another thing that makes me think gold and silver have turned, that is, have made a bottom, is to look at the stock markets in gold and silver. And these are very strange charts. They don't, they're very gappy charts. Charts don't normally look like these charts look. But it's pretty clear to me, I thought that they had made an island reversal, which is where a market gaps up, trades sideways for a few days, and then gaps back down. But apparently they haven't. But they certainly look like they've topped. And it's interesting that the stocks, senior indices have made new highs recently, and that has not translated to new highs in the Dow in gold and the Dow in silver. So that in itself is a bullish sign, because that Dow in gold and Dow in silver tend to be more sensitive to turns in the market, even than the individual markets themselves. And then finally, racing through the markets here, I want you to think about the U.S. dollar index. If you look at the chart, you can see that it's rolled over. It's made a rounding top, and it's broken the uptrend line. And if it goes below about 82, then the dollar then gravity will take over. On the other hand, it might still, even from where it is, might simply come down to 82 and bounce and go on back up to 84. There are a lot of reasons in the world, like European banking crisis and what the Japanese are doing to their currency, to make you think the dollar might go up. And certainly, if we got an outburst of panic like we got in 2008, then you'd see the dollar go up. People are going to run into dollars. But I think the dollar is broken, and it appears, looking at the yield on the 10-year Treasury bond, which moves opposite to the bond, and the bond is sort of a proxy for dollars, because that's where people run when they want to go into dollars. The bond appears to have topped, or at least stopped going up, which means the yield is rising, which means there's not as much demand for dollars. So unless the dollar turns around from 82 here pretty soon, or 81.80, then you have to assume that the dollar is going to cheapen a lot. It's hard to imagine how anyone thinks that quantitative easing is going to help the economy, but the propaganda effort that's taken over is that the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 are proxy for the performance of the U.S. economy, which is, of course, not true. And they have been floated higher on a sea of new money. So it's not economic strength that's carrying them higher. It's all that new money. And that's all I've got to say about that.
One of the things I wanted to talk about, because I spend a lot of time with various, especially clients, talking about whether or not they want to rebalance in or out of gold and silver. And I wanted to just walk through a framework as to how somebody thinks about this. I know we certainly have plenty of people who listen to the Precious Metals Market Report who got into precious metals quite early and have now lived through what has been a much longer consolidation since 2011 than we thought about. And you're sitting here and you're thinking, you know, should I stay in high balances of precious metals? Or if you don't have big positions, you know, I thought I'd missed it, but is this now the time to finally get in? So I just wanted to talk through a framework I use and think about this in terms of how you manage your risk. To me, the real big question, Franklin, is will the primary trend reassert itself or not? And by primary trend, I mean the primary trend up in gold and silver, and the ability of gold and silver to protect you against debasement of the global currencies, including the dollar. And if you asked me that question this week, I would have said 80-20, 80% chance it reasserts, 20% chance it doesn't. And the 20% chance is, you know, scenarios. I never, as you know, I never underestimate the power of Mr. Global to slow burn a price up or down, if that's in his, you know, sort of political advantage to do. So, you know, I've always believed they wanted to manage rise. But what I say to people is, look, if you're concerned that the primary trend might not reassert, you know, you figure out what you think the odds are. So I say 80-20. My guess is you'll say 90-10 or something higher than me. And then decide, okay, well, if it turns out to be the 20, how much, you know, how much are you willing to rebalance out of now? And how much are you willing to let ride and see if that, you know, you'll be comfortable if the 20% happens and you can live with that. The one thing I do say is that if you come out of precious metals, you've got to go into something. And, you know, if you look at all the charts, it's a lot more attractive to leave stocks and go into precious metals right now than to leave, as you said, precious metals and go into equities, to go into cash, to go into a lot of things. And I think the thing I try and underscore is we're coming into a real change in paradigm where we can get radical changes in currencies, we can get radical changes in the federal budget, in federal tax policy. All sorts of things can happen, especially if gun ownership or enforcement, local enforcement, is compromised by a system of drones. And we'll talk about after that, we listen to Larry. When you're coming into that kind of paradigm shift, as you and I were talking at dinner, you want to make sure that you have lots of real assets, because anything can happen. Chris Powell used to always talk about a radical debasement where you go to bed and gold's at 1550 and you wake up the next morning and it's 3000, and they've just completely marked the debt to market. And don't you wish you hadn't sold your gold at that point? So we need to understand we're coming into a paradigm shift. And, you know, in those kinds of paradigm shifts, we can see whole asset classes get totally wiped out. You know, anything. Real estate, cash, equities, precious metals, who knows? The reason I like to have a framework like this week I was calling it confiscation by mind control, because if you're the Secretary of the Treasury and you're the head of the Federal Reserve and there's real stress within the institutional gold inventories and there's tremendous pressure because the insiders know what's coming, and so they want to accumulate as much gold as possible and do it quietly. What's the best way? I mean, yes, you can go get legislation or you can announce a national emergency and confiscate, but then everybody's going to hoard. Everybody's going to buy. Everybody's going to want. How do you bring in the most gold the fastest? This is how you do it. And if you look at your ability with the ability to buy bonds and print money and use the exchange stabilization fund, this is a far cheaper way to confiscate. So my fear, my fear is not that I wake up tomorrow with gold at 1250, as Goldman said for 2014. My fear is I wake up tomorrow and I don't have the tangibles I need or the precious metals to trade for tangibles that I need to survive that radical change in paradigm. Anyway, so that's my framework. You got in?
You had a very elegant way of explaining how I stay out of bar fights. You know how to stay out of bar fights, right? Leave the bar before the fight starts. And that's exactly what you're talking about, is get out of the bar when you see that the fight might break out. And because it's too late. After they do it, and these surprise parties, governments are notorious for throwing these surprise parties over weekend when you can't get to your bank, you can't do, you can't take any protective action at all. So I think you've got to take your action now while there's not a fight going on in the bar. Otherwise, you just won't be able to do it. You'll just be one of the unnumbered victims in the net. So I think you're right. I think another thing that you and I talked about at supper tonight was The 1980s saw an increasing level of abstraction in financial products. Everything was turned into some sort of derivative, some sort of financial derivative, and then derivatives of derivatives on top of derivatives, so that the level of abstraction increases and increases and increases until finally you've got literally derivatives that nobody understands, nobody except the people
right.
that are selling them. So I have to, if I believe, and I do believe, that the things, the wealth of the world comes from the things men take out of the ground, then there has to be some connection to reality with whatever my investment is. Now, that might be something like gold and silver, where you actually hold the physical stuff in your hand, or it might be owning a company that produces something that real people want to buy, eat, consume, use, and so forth. But there's a real production going on there. If I buy Goldman Sachs, what am I buying? I'm buying a part of a company that deals in abstractions, who deals in unrealities. And so I want to stay as far from that end of the spectrum, of the reality spectrum, as I can. I want to stay
right.
as far away from the abstract spectrum and get closer to the reality spectrum. So,
right.
and, you know.
And that means living with risk. That means living with things going up and down and up and down and up and down. And what I'm watching as is, you know, an individual who's not used to, I grew up at a firm on Wall Street where we lived with wild risk. We, you know, it was oil and gas, it was mining, it was, you know, it was very concrete industries, and people who were used to thinking of everything as a monopoly board. And I didn't understand the idea of everybody counting their money every 24 hours or 30 days in terms of dollars and the extent to which you could get played that way. And I'm not saying don't look at your wealth or, you know, don't be willing to value it in different kinds of currencies. But we need to think of ourselves as players in the game of economic warfare and not get tricked at the micro level. So
but let me say something about risk, okay? You know, I don't know how many airline pilots or, you know, professional pilots that you know, but they are people who take tremendous risks every day. I mean, think about it. Would you
right.
climb into the cab of an airplane and try to pilot it anywhere? I certainly wouldn't. And yet, they know they're very good investors, in my experience, and I've done business with a lot of them. And the reason they're very good investors is they can analyze the risk, and they can see through. They can see far enough into the future. They realize they can weigh the odds and say this thing outweighs the potential for this to succeed outweighs the risk that it will fail. And
mm-hmm.
so they're very good at weighing those risks. So I don't want to accept the kind of risks. You were talking about your uncle at supper who bought in 2009 shares in Whole Foods. Well, if you knew anything about the food market and the trends in the market, that was not a risk. That was a sure thing.
Right.
That was shooting fish in a rain barrel. That's the kind of quote risk that I want to take. And that's
right.
the way that I feel about gold and silver, because I know the forces that are working in their favor. So it's a different take on risk.
Right. But every asset that we could invest in has political risk. And gold and silver have the political risk that the price can be driven down. And if you're going to invest in it, if you're going to hold gold and silver, you've got to be able to manage that. And you've got to make sure whatever your position is, you can live with that. So I always call it my cow moments, when they drive the price down and I go back to the cow pasture behind my house. Talk to the cows and they look at me and say, you need to chill out here. Okay, let me, we've got a ton of questions coming in, so let me ask some. Does Mr. Global and the central banks actually want to accumulate gold and silver, even if there is a rise in price, so they will find this acceptable?
Well, I know that central banks are buying gold and have been buying gold at increasing rates for about 10 years, nearly 10 years. And so, it's like every other sphere in the world. watch what people do, not what people say. However much they talk gold down and say it's a barbarous relic and all that sort of stuff, nonetheless, they're putting their money in it. So,
right. Another question. Since powerful players want the metals to go lower, what keeps them from raising margins and causing the markets to go lower significantly? Excellent question.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Since powerful players want the markets to go lower, what keeps them from raising margins and causing the markets to go lower significantly?
Well, that would take an egregious breach of the rules that they've already set up for themselves. And, I mean, they raised margins a lot in 2011, but a lot of people didn't understand that they were just raising the margins in accordance with the rises in the price, and futures markets always do that to protect the market makers. So I don't see as much significance in the raising and lowering of those margins as other people may. I mean, it's what they do, and I don't expect them to play fair anyway, so I'm not terribly surprised by it. But I think the methods of controlling the market are a lot less direct than manipulating margins.
Right. And the other thing I would say is I think right now there is tremendous concern about the stress in the institutional inventories and agreements between different institutions. And so whatever way you need to bring in gold, you need to not put more pressure on those institutions. So you want to bring in precious metals from retail, but you don't want to create more stress in those institutional relationships.
Right. Let me make a point. Let me make
okay.
one little point here. You have no idea how thin the physical gold and silver markets are. When I say you do, but I'm saying your listeners don't realize how thin they are. I knew somebody who had, like, not a very big order, like a $15 million order, and he literally could not enter that order without moving the market, even in smallish tranches. So it's a very thin market.
One of the things that's interesting, I don't know if you've looked at the inventory that's come out of the GLD inventory. It's pretty scary, and you wonder, where in the world is all of that going? Somebody's taking a lot of inventory out, and if you look at the size of it, you almost wonder if it isn't swaps where, you know, people are bringing in their shares and trying to engineer swaps, which in theory you're allowed to do. But it's pretty scary. You wonder where all that inventory is disappearing to. A couple questions about banking in Hong Kong, which I'll handle either next time or email directly. Then one on gun control, which we'll do after we listen to Larry. And then after Cyprus, I went to get my gold out of safety deposit box. I live outside the U.S. and can't transport my gold here. What's the best option for physical storage in the U.S. but outside the banking system, or is it gold money?
Well, if not gold money, which I like, by the way, I can give four different suggestions for storage. But, you know, any storage is subject to all of the problems of storage. Down in New Orleans, there's a place called the Security Center, and you can look at www.securitycenterneworleans.com. They have storage, and they actually offer the service of going into your box if you empower them to do that, and they can receive deliveries on your behalf and make shipments on your behalf. There's another one that does offer similar service out in Idaho, goldandsilvervault.com. I don't know much about them. They're fairly new, the last 3 or 4 years. Security Center has been around for 30 years probably. And then there's C&T Depository in Bridgewater, Massachusetts, which I have visited, looked at. It's now a COMEX-approved depository, and it offers fungible storage, that is segregated storage. That's the highest on my list. There's also DDSC in Delaware, and most of the IRAs in the country are stored with them. And they do a credible job. I'm not terribly enthusiastic about them because they can be very slow to move. And we've done a lot of IRA swaps where it would take, you know, 30, sometimes 45 days or even 60 days to get them all completed. And that seems like an awful long time to me. But they are another choice, Delaware Depository.
Right. I think Delaware Depository does most of the IRA-related business, is my experience. A couple more questions. We can't handle them all because there's a lot coming in. One question about what we think of the analysis of the folks at King World News. You want to take that? I'm delighted to take that.
Why don't you take that? Because I don't really listen to them.
Okay, so my answer is I don't listen to King World News. And in my experience, it's not, designed to be exciting and entertaining, but is not particularly useful and certainly is not related to being smart about managing your money. They do have some good people on. One of the questions was about Jim Sinclair, who I like very much, but Jim is someone who doesn't agree with my slow burn analysis. And so he's often much more optimistic about where the price of gold is going. And, I look at things, he looks at things more through a market analysis, whereas I look at things as very much a political analysis. So, but I have a lot of respect for him. And there's some, you know, James Turk, other good people who go on King World News. But I just, you know, King World News is not a source that I listen to and is not a source I would recommend. Okay, why don't we take time now to listen to the recording of Larry Pratt. And for those of you who want to stay with us, as soon as the recording is over, Franklin and I will connect the dots back between gun ownership and the gold and silver market and protecting your financial assets and maybe take a few more of these questions before we call it an evening. So without further ado, Justin, let's hear from Larry. It's my privilege to have join us on the Saleri Report, Larry Pratt. Larry is the executive director of Gun Owners of America. He's been the executive director for over 30 years. Gun Owners of America is a national membership organization. It has over 300,000 members, and it's dedicated to promoting the Second Amendment freedom to bear arms, to keep and bear arms. Gun Owners of America lobbies in Washington and is involved as well in the state issues. Larry is an author. His most recent book, On the Firing Line, Essays in the Defense of Liberty, is available at his website for Gun Owners of America. Larry has also held elective office in the state legislature of Virginia, where he resides, and Gun Owners of America is based in Springfield, Virginia. He also directs a number of public interest organizations, including serving as vice chairman of the American Institute for Cancer Research. And perhaps most importantly, in my opinion, he has emerged as the most eloquent spokesperson for representing people like you and me who are interested in the importance of freedom and the rights to bear arms. So, Larry, it is a real privilege to have you on the Saleri Report.
Well, thank you so much. It's really good to be with you. Appreciate the nice introduction.
Well, the current administration won the election, and they got their bit in their teeth, and often running with gun control. Maybe if you could describe to us what finally emerged from the president's proposal and then what your position has been, and sort of if you could give us a sense of what's happened since then.
Well, the president made a speech in which he outlined some 23 things that he wanted to see accomplished in the area of firearms, all of which were unconstitutional, none of which have legislative authority. And I'm not sure that he wouldn't try to move on all of them, because he doesn't seem to be a man bothered by absence of constitutional authority or congressional authorization. So we've got our hands full. He's given us the list of what it is he's going to try to take, and I think we've seen from his behavior in other areas that the lack of authorization and authority doesn't serve as an impediment for
right,
this man.
Right.
So we're concerned, and we would see that the right to keep and bear arms is under an assault probably like never before.
One of the things I've been very interested in, I served in the first Bush administration as Assistant Secretary of Housing. One of the things I've been very interested in is what is the impetus to do this? You know, as soon as the election was over, this was front burner, and it certainly felt like promises had been made before the, you know, during the campaign. And one of the things I've wondered is you're watching across the country an enormous change in ownership in real estate, and the extent to which, you know, that this is a financial issue. In other words, if you're going to continue to, you know, if you're going to raise taxes, if you're going to cut expenses, if you're going to start changing real estate and selling an enormous amount of real estate, which is now under federal or central bank control, you know, investors have reason to be worried the tempers could flare. So one of my questions has been, you know, what's the push for this? This is a pretty aggressive push, and it's clearly a priority. What's really driving this at this point in time? Do you have any sense?
Well, the president, by his own admission, really, is a socialist. He's a follower of Saul Alinsky, and he obviously firmly believes that because he won the election, he can do anything he wants. And he thinks that, as he told Joe the plumber, things go better when we spread them around. Now, he didn't point to any countries where that had been done successfully, but the socialist is really a happy sort of fellow who's able to continue believing in something, even though time after time it doesn't work. He knows that the next time it will, because it'll be done by him this time, and all the other times he wasn't available to make it work right. I've actually heard socialists say that. Senator Kennedy said that to Milton Friedman when he was testifying before Congress, and even a relative of mine has the same opinion. So this is a conceit of the socialist that makes them, I think, so dangerous, because they just know that their ideas have to work, that it's the only just way. And, of course, one of those just ways is to have us disarmed. I can understand why they're so in favor of disarmament, because when they mess things up the next time, we're not going to be any happier than we were before, and they don't want us armed when it gets to be really tough
right,
going.
Right.
So that, I think that explains the issue right there. It's about control. In fact, I have a little weekly show, the Gun Owners News Hour, and the announcer in the segue to my coming on says, and remember, it's not just about gun control. It's about
control.
Right, it's about control.
And you know, it's funny because my experience with these folks is that I haven't found them to be socialists. I just have found them to be, you know, wanting more control.
I'll never forget,
when I first became Assistant Secretary of Housing, I met with a couple of the leaders of a task force on housing who were from the Democratic side, and they had come up with a commission that proposed that you decentralize a lot more of the housing programs and let the state and local governments run them. And the folks in the Bush administration were proposing more centralization. They said, but I thought you were Republicans. I thought you were for decentralization. And they looked at them and they said, yeah, but we're here now.
Well, you're kinder than I am. I would say that was a socialist mindset. I'm sure they wouldn't call themselves that, because they have an awareness of how unpopular that can be, particularly in many parts of America. But the fact that they believe in a central control and that they're the ones that can do it, because you said, we're here now.
Right.
That fits the my definition to a T. And, in fact, Bush the Second even allowed us how he had had to use a little socialism to save capitalism. At least that was his opinion. And that was his statement regarding his stimulus. And it's amazing that even the Republicans now have all too many bought into the idea that somehow there is a role for government that never was imagined in the, shall we say, the Republican model. But now that we're here, we see that we'll use it responsibly.
Well, you know, what has happened is you now have generations of people, whether at the local level or in Washington, who've never worked in a real economy, have never worked in a productive economy. You know, we've had 50 years of...
Freedom is frightening.
Right. And you know, something, economic productivity is hard. You know, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of practice. And, you know, the entire economy has been washed in a sea of government money and government credit. And so it's a rare, you know, that they're throughout the country, there are entrepreneurs who have functioned in the market and know what market economics are and how and wonderful they can be. But it's a discipline a lot of us have really lost touch with. So I understand exactly what you're saying. The only thing is socialism implies some kind of commitment to the ordinary citizen, and that's not something I see in a lot of these proposals.
That's the theory. But of course, in practice, the only thing I've ever seen in the way of people being benefited is the leaders of a socialist scheme do very well. They'll live very, very well. In the Soviet Union, they had the country houses, the dachas.
Right, right.
They had the limos and the chauffeurs. And everybody else was lucky to take a bus. So that's the socialist reality. There's no getting around
right,
it.
Right.
The milder cases of socialism that we see in Western Europe are actually now being gradually abandoned. Scandinavia in particular is noteworthy because they are consciously jettisoning many of their socialist schemes because they saw they didn't
right.
work.
Planned economies don't work. I mean, that's... I'm not saying there aren't rare exceptions, but planned economies generally don't work.
Well, I saw an exception with my own eyes. My wife is Panamanian.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And at the time I first began going to Panama, there was a Panama Canal Zone. And the Panama Canal Zone, many Panamanians, as well as Americans, realized that were living there in country, this zone is the one place where socialism has ever worked effectively. And that's because it was a small number of people with a virtually unlimited supply of
right,
money.
Right.
You could have your grass cut for you. I mean, you could be kind of low on the totem pole in the canal zone structure, and life was large.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And it came to an end.
That's right. That's right.
Eventually, yeah. They ran out of other people's money.
Well, tell us what... just watching as an observer, you've been in the thick of this. Watching from the, you know, here in Tennessee, what I see is that the pushback on this effort has been enormous, and the administration has, in many respects, really been stopped dead in their tracks.
I am beginning to be cautiously optimistic that their agenda is not going anywhere. Not at the federal level, which in some ways was probably the biggest area of danger, but even at the state level. There are going to be some exceptions, Connecticut, California, and so forth. But by and large, the states are actually pushing back. There are over half of the states that have told the federal government that at a minimum they won't cooperate in any unconstitutional federal gun control. And there are some states that have actually gone so far as to say, or sheriffs, if not the whole state government with legislation pending, sheriffs have already said, we'll arrest
right.
you if
right.
you come in here and try to confiscate guns. So the lines are being more and more clearly drawn between the imperial city of Washington and the folks on the other side of the river, as it were. And increasingly, I think there's a self-conscious determination on the part of many, not all, but many in the rest of the country to say, federal government, I don't know what makes you think you can do these things, but you're not going to do them in our county, in our state.
Well, it's interesting. I'll use myself as an example. If you look at my personal situation in Hickory Valley, Tennessee, several years ago, we had the drug gangs come in and do a whole series of home invasions, and all the members of the Hickory Valley Women's Club went out, got their training, got their carry permits, and, you know, now the joke in Hickory Valley is the husbands have to sleep with bulletproof vests. And you know, no problems ever since. We have no problems in Hickory Valley. But
Armed society is a polite society.
But the reality is, Larry, if tomorrow we had to turn in our guns, what I would tell you is I think the drug gangs will have a field day here. And it would not be safe. In fact,
I'm hearing from so many places in the country, nobody is going to turn in their guns, no matter who tells them.
There is no way I'm going to turn in my guns. There is no way, because if I do, you know, then I have to leave. I don't know if I have to, you know, I certainly have to leave where I can't live here. It wouldn't be safe. And then the question, of course, is where are you going to go? I'm not going to go back to Washington. So I think my situation, just from watching the people in my county, is duplicated all across certainly rural America. So, and if you look at the things that are making us not safe, those criminal elements, in my opinion, are very much tolerated, if not promoted, if not related to, you know, the same people who are running the federal government. So
it's not a concern to them. They don't care how many of us get bumped off or extorted. They've got their own security details that you and I pay for. Crime for them is only a distant concept. And so if you and I are having to struggle because we don't have a gun, well, that's just too bad.
Well, it's interesting. The our theme on the Saleri Report for 2013 is coming clean. And, you know, sort of one of my theories is if you want to see change in the world, just, you know, do it in your own life first and before you tell anybody else. So to me, the coming clean on gun control is if, you know, Biden and the president can simply, you know, ask the Secret Service to not carry guns on their protection details.
I think that would be a very convincing gesture on their part that somehow gun control is feasible and is something that they're willing to lead by example.
Right.
The fact that they don't, of course, tells me that, well, that I'm more important than you guys, and I need protection.
Right. My children
are more
important
than your children.
That's the clear message.
We need 14 armed guards at our children's school, but who are you to demand a guard at yours?
Right.
The hypocrisy is so lovely. And I must say that we at Gun Owners of America do appreciate Double Barrel Joe. His instruction to the nation about the virtues of shotguns has just been absolutely entertaining. And the idea of shooting out the front door while it's closed is something that never would have occurred to me. I am just so enlightened by this vice president of ours. Double Barrel Joe is just a terrific guy. I must say, I'm glad I'm not on his Secret Service because I don't think that would be much fun.
No, I wouldn't. Now, one of the things I did when the administration first made the proposals is I did some research to try and find the best statistics on sort of what are the facts of gun use in America. And I finally recommended to the subscribers, I think it's called Point Blank, which is a little bit dated, but has it's by the criminologist in Florida.
Gary Kleck.
And, you know, one of the things, it certainly fit with my experience and what I knew, but one of the things which is quite remarkable about gun ownership is how effective it is for protecting the honest people.
The data, when you look at it, Kleck, as you say, maybe somewhat dated, but he was the pioneer, and his findings have only been corroborated more recently by Dr. John Lott, who, after writing a book full of mind-numbing econometric equations and conclusions, did finally write some in English that more guns, less crime. And it was absolutely predictable with very few outliers that the more guns in a jurisdiction, the less violent crime. And that's not something that goes well with the liberal worldview, because their assumption is that only the government can effectively do anything for us, and certainly in areas as important as protecting life and limb. But the fact of the matter is the law of every state in our country is that our police are not responsible for providing for personal protection.
Right.
So you're on your own, bud. And anybody that thinks that the government is there to help them it just doesn't understand. And it's not to say that if a cop could help, he wouldn't, but mostly it's to say cops can't help because criminals don't usually strike when the cops are around. And so we're on our own.
Well, the other thing is, you know, if you look, I'm in a very rural county, and we have a fantastic sheriff that we organized several years ago and really made an extraordinary effort to get an excellent sheriff elected, which was an enormous blessing for us. But if you look at his budget and the size of the county and the pressure on him to use his staff to process foreclosures, all across America, what you're seeing is the sheriff's office has a choice. It can try and protect the citizens with what budget he has, or he can process foreclosures for the banks. And there's tremendous tension in terms of use of resources. And there's no way that they can be, as you said, they can be there quickly enough to protect you.
One of the things that has been, almost we could call it a movement, is that not any longer are we talking about a sheriff here and maybe two or three others somewhere else in the country of a similar mind, but county after county, we're seeing sheriffs who understand that they're the top cop in their county because they're the only elected police officer in the county. And as such, they take precedence over the FBI or, frankly, even the Secret Service. They are the top cop. And whatever they say goes because they're the only one that's been elected. They're the only
right.
one that has received
right.
a direct transfer or extension of authority from we the people. And so we're seeing sheriffs who, as they come to understand this, increasingly being willing to tell the federal government, no, you're not going to confiscate guns in my county or I'll arrest you.
Right, right.
And hundreds now of sheriffs are taking similar positions. They're also protecting, in a case of, I'm happy to say, one of our members, Sheriff Brad Rogers in Elkhart County, Indiana, was approached by a dairy farmer who producing raw milk, something that the FDA, for whatever reason, loathes. It is something that they want to extirpate
right.
from the market. And they had been doing inspections and harassing this guy. Finally, since he wouldn't stop producing raw milk, they said, well, that's it. If you don't stop by such and such a date, we're going to get a court order and confiscate your equipment. And so he went to the sheriff and said, this is what's happening. Can you help me? And Sheriff Rogers did go out to look at the property just to make sure he wasn't buying a pig in a poke, as it were. But, of course, as any raw milk producer would almost certainly be, this guy was running a very, very clean operation. And so the sheriff communicated with the attorney for the Food and Drug Administration was the one harassing the guy back in Washington and said, if you put a foot on his property, I'm going to arrest you. And the attorney wrote back and said, well, if you try that, we'll arrest you. And
they don't have authority to arrest the sheriff.
No, they don't. And he knew that. He knows his constitution quite well. The Food and Drug Administration is not able to derive their authority from the Constitution. Certainly nowhere in Article 1, Section 8, or anywhere else in the Constitution will we find the words food and drugs. So anyway, he told them that you don't have authority, and therefore I'm going to protect the citizen in my county. And then when they threatened to arrest him, he said, well, game on. And that was 15 months ago, and there's still not moving against the farmer. He's still producing raw milk. And that's what a
sheriff...
And
what's the name of the sheriff, Larry?
Brad Rogers. Yeah, he's just a wonderful guy. He's homeschooling his kids. And, couldn't ask for a nicer guy. But I'll tell you what, you don't want to mess with Sheriff Rogers.
Right, and I'm very concerned about the use of drones domestically. And one of my concerns about them, particularly if they're fielded by the military or the federal government, is the use of those to in any way intimidate the sheriffs.
It seems to me that we're going to have to develop a technology that can deal with the drones. At the moment, they've got the advantage because they can fly higher and wider. But I think the time's going to have to come when we get our own. The sheriff maybe gets his own missile.
No, it doesn't sound over the top to me, Larry. I've worked in Washington.
Drones are over the top, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's got to stop. And I think if we start pulling them down, they'll get the idea that, well, over Fayette County, you just don't mess around.
So, no, I don't think it's over the top at all. I would love to see the sheriffs have missiles to take out the drones. Let me talk a little bit about actions and what people can do. One of the things that I was at a meeting of I'm a member of the Tennessee Firearms Association, and I was at a meeting and discovered that according to the TFA, we have a membership which is now more than 50% of the actively voting population in Tennessee. So, I know, that's what I said. So you're reaching a critical mass somehow of people who understand, because when I left Washington in 1998, and I said, if there's one thing worth dying for, it's the right to bear arms. Because, you know, this situation, you've got a group of people who can always come up with more ways to control, and there's nothing to stop them. You know, they're on a roll. So, you know, you just, at some point. Now, I wanted to also mention, I have many wonderful subscribers and clients and investors from, you know, who've lived in the city in very protected and wonderful environments. And to them, they can't even conceive of this issue. Why is this a problem? Who needs a gun? And they're lovely people, and they're very intelligent people. And, you know, but they really have not either lived through the dangers of what the federal government might be up to. You know, they haven't run into it yet personally, or they haven't had to deal with crime the way certainly people in the rural areas have had to deal with that.
Or on the border.
Right.
I was
right
at a meeting this morning. I talked to a lady who told me some horrendous accounts of living on the border, along the Mexican border. And the activity of the cartels is so brazen that now they're doing what they had done in Mexico as well, well into the United States, including walking into somebody's house, guns drawn, telling them they got 15 minutes to leave. They can gather what belongings they can in that time. And before you leave, sign with this notary here that you're signing over the house to us. And then the house becomes a safe house for the cartel.
And
the people are, you know, they get 10 bucks for their house as a, you know, make it a legal
and
sale.
It's very important for everybody listening to understand it has been proven beyond a shadow of the doubt that the Department of Justice has been providing the cartels with weapons.
That it was called Fast and Furious, at least one of the ways that they were doing
right.
that.
Right.
Fast and Furious was a particular program in Phoenix, but we're almost 100% certain that they were doing same things in other cities in Texas and probably in New Mexico as well. And it's just unbelievable.
Well, it's, you know, and, you know, you don't have to agree with this, Larry, but my feeling watching Eric Holder at the press conference is, wait a minute, you know, I'm dealing with criminals who you're arming and who are making you money, you know, and I need to protect myself from your syndicates. So I need a gun because, and I'm not going to go along with you taking away my gun because that's just going to empower your syndicates to do more harm to me. I mean, you know, which side, these guys are on both sides of the game at this point.
Well, I've never heard the intensity of pushback that we're hearing now and we have been for the last many, many months, people are to the point where I don't think they're going to be pushed any farther. And it could well be that some bureaucrat in the next few days or months is going to tell some American citizen what he can and cannot do, and the bureaucrat is going to be told in no uncertain terms, get out of my house, get out of my store, get off my land, or I'm shooting you. People are that fed up. The idea that these little tin pot dictators run around assuming that whatever they say is the law, when in fact they are lawless. And people are increasingly to the point where they're going to treat them like any other common criminal.
The only thing I have to say, and maybe I've been out of Washington for long, most of the bureaucrats I dealt with were great people and didn't want any part of this. You know, now they were going along because they wanted to get paid, but...
Well, somebody's writing those orders what we have to do and don't do, and they're going to have to get somebody to enforce them when people increasingly say, well, you've written the order, so what?
Right.
It's just an amazing thing. The contempt for government has become palpable. And I really wondered if it would ever happen. Was there ever a point we could be pushed to that people would say that's it?
Well, I think the bailouts have done it, because if you look at the financial issues, you know, we're watching large financial institutions make 300% on a defaulted mortgage, and it's clearly being engineered from Washington and the central banks. So, you know, it's gotten pretty obvious, and people can connect the dots to what they're watching locally. So the one thing that does concern me, Larry, is that that I'm starting to see the respect for the military also decline. And that's a dangerous situation, because the military, if you look at what's keeping the entire financial game going, it's the military that holds it up. And so, you know, if the military should lose that respect, then we're in a very different world financially, globally.
I think a lot of people are increasingly concerned that we are on the brink of a time of disorder that has been instigated by the reckless policies of our central government, and to a certain extent with co-starring roles by other government officials elsewhere. And I think it's reaching a very critical point. And I'm not sure if the folks that are ensconced in their comfy offices in Washington and other government centers really understand just how desperate people are, how disgusted people are. But this isn't a good way to be. And it's not, I don't think, going to continue too much longer without something snapping.
Right. And I think the two of the issues that this is going to come down to, so I was very interested in your Brad Rogers story, is control of the food supply and the right to bear arms. That's what it's going to come down to.
Hey, my, if you have control of those two things, that's sort of the ball game, isn't it?
Yep. And I think one of the desire to control the food supply is very much, it gets back to this question of the taxes in the land, is very much driving the push to get the arms rules changed. Well, let's talk about what people can do. If I'm a, you know, I'm a busy family, I got three kids, I'm working, I'm trying to, you know, hold it together. What can I do this week, next week? What can I do to support you and people like you, making sure that the administration's proposals die a quick or slow death?
Gun Owners of America has been organized as a grassroots lobby. We try to facilitate our members being able to get information from us and then either send off a postcard or an email or the information for a phone call, whatever, to keep the heat on primarily members of Congress, which is our main focus. And that means that everybody that's getting our information can be a citizen lobbyist. Doesn't take a lot of their time, almost no expense, but it really can add up, because if enough people are calling and writing and generally putting the heat on, eventually they see the light. It's as old Senator Dirksen was fond of saying, that when I feel the heat, I see the light. Which is pretty much the way he used to speak. With
it's
that
true.
Old,
you know, it's true. If they if they get a couple letters or a couple phone calls, you know, and if they get a real... I'll never forget during the bailouts, I like my congressperson very much. It's Marsha Blackburn. And I would call her staff and say, do not vote for this bailout. Vote no, vote no. And finally they said, we're not even taking names and addresses. It's just, we're overwhelmed. And she voted no on the bailouts twice. So, but they, you know, they absolutely do respond when the heat comes in. So it makes a difference.
And as you and I both know, she was under enormous pressure within the Beltway to go along with the bailout.
Yeah.
And it's almost impossible to understand how that can happen, except for those of you listening, keep in mind that inside the Beltway is like being in a hermetically sealed room.
Right.
And there are no inputs that enter the room other than those that are strictly controlled.
Right.
And you just have no sense of the reality of the world outside that.
And that pressure can be so terrifying, you know.
Absolutely. Now, when you get outside the room and you look back and say, what was I afraid of? But it's like the guy behind the curtain in, that old fable of, you know, the gal with the red shoes in Kansas. And,
right.
The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
And they finally discover that the wizard's just this little old guy behind a curtain and cranking out this smoke and everything. It was all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
That's
no, but those guys, when they turn on the heat, it's, you know, the entire global financial system will crash. It'll be your fault. And,
yeah,
I mean, the pressure can be very intense. And
well, we had to have the bailout right away, because if we don't get it tomorrow, the financial system going to collapse and the end of the world will be at hand and we'll all die.
Right. And here's the interesting thing, because when the bailout got turned down the first time, it was almost as though the rule of law had been asserted. And, of course, what a financial system needs more than anything is the rule of law.
Yep.
Without the rule of law, you know, the whole thing goes to chaos. So it was really funny. It was the American people who reminded everybody, okay, what it is that, you know, a financial system needs to go. Because as soon as they approved the second, the money started flying out the door. You know, I mean, we all see where this went.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, so keep us going. What else can we do?
Well, if folks will go to gunowners.org, they can get on our alert list. They'll get an alert from us this week. I have to confess, they probably got one every day, because the battle has been so intense. And each time something comes, it'll have an email embedded in it that can be sent off to the appropriate member of Congress. And it really has kind of revolutionized lobbying, because we don't have to, since we work and depend heavily on the grassroots, our members, to impact the Congress, the fact that we can now communicate electronically and get a feedback the same day makes a huge difference in the way we can deal with what they try to get away with here in Washington. So the gunowners.org, it's a free service. Just get get on that alert list, and the information that comes, I think, will be stuff that you're not going to get on the evening news.
Right. Okay, well, Larry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to be with you.
I look forward to seeing, I've signed up at Gun Owners of America, so I look forward to getting the alerts
And spread the word out there in Hickory Valley. It sounds like you're almost in paradise.
We're all
Tennessee, right?
Yeah, it's we're in West Tennessee. I'm outside of Memphis.
I didn't know you had any valleys that far west. All right.
You know, I'm not sure that folks from East Tennessee would consider this a valley, but in West Tennessee, it's a valley.
If you think it's a valley, you go ahead and call.
Anyway, you keep doing our work for us, and we will keep supporting, and we appreciate it very much, everything you're doing.
Thank you so much. It's really nice of you, and look forward to being with you again sometime.
Okay, have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's Larry Pratt from Gun Owners of America. I wanted to update or add two things to that interview. Franklin, you haven't heard this story yet, but today I was on the phone with somebody who called me and said, now, what's the problem with Obamacare? Why do I care if the insurance companies have my data? You know, I just don't think this is a big deal. And right after I hung up from the conversation, in comes an article from New York and an interview. It's posted up on the blog, attorney describing several of his cases. He's been hired by people who've been stripped of their gun permits because they have been taking psychotropic drugs. You know, I don't know if it's Valium or Ritalin or, you know, whatever. And of course, one of the questions is, how in the world did the government get that data?